Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Today's Wednesday, January 2nd, 20th, rather, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. My name is Hezzy Eris, and today we're going to talk about the transition from the former president, who's already left Washington, D.C., and anticipating the swearing in of Mr. Biden, who will be the next president of the United States. So helping me today will be none other than, the editor and editor-in-chief and the publisher, Gabriella Metzl. She's the publisher of the Unvarnished blog. See, she just came on, so let's pull her in. Good morning, Gabrielle. How are you?
I am wonderful on this day of pomp and circumstance, Hezzy. How are you?
Pomp and circumstances? Are you kidding me? Well, okay. Well, the stakes are awesome today, that's for sure. So we'll see how much pomp and circumstance can obliterate the responsibility of a new administration. He's got a lot of heavy lifting to do, this new president.
Indeed, absolutely. It's going to be an interesting ride. There's so much that incoming President Biden wants to do in this first day, not even just the first 100 days. It's going to make it interesting for people like you and me, Hezzy. That's for sure.
Well, that's for sure. That is for sure. I mean, but you know, you mentioned that Biden wants to make a lot of changes, or I don't know, tweak this or tweak that. But in a sense, he comes on board as the next president, because he'll be sworn in, I think, at 12 noon today, with a tremendous amount of responsibility that will weigh on him, and he's got a lot of things to fix. You know, he's got the weight of the world on his back. Is he ready for the responsibility? Or do we have a clue of what he needs to do?
To be perfectly honest, it's an interesting time. When we switch between presidents, it's an interesting time to reflect on the successes and failures of the last presidency and what we really want going forward as a country. And to in many respects, both the House, the Senate, and the presidency are controlled by one Democratic Party. But in many ways, the Democratic Party is as fractured as the Republican Party has been. There isn't a clear vision, and certainly there isn't a vision going forward for in terms of how polarized the opposites actually are especially in Congress. There isn't, no matter if we want to say that today is supposed to be some sort of day of unity, things of that nature, there isn't unity. There isn't a type of unifying force that one of the things, especially when they talk about peaceful transitions of power, is the fact that there's a culture there, some sort of connecting piece that allows for that transition to happen. And we're quickly dwindling on what some would call social capital that allows us to come together even after such a difficult turn like this, a difficult and challenging competition, because that's what politics is, right? I mean, let's not sugarcoat it.
Sure it is.
There was
such an assault, for example, in the last few years with Trump and his administration. Maybe there was some responsibility on his part as well because of his lack of expression that was robust with meaning. You know, you can't tweet your way to the height of the world and relevance. So that was his issue. But now we've got a new president that will be sworn in at 12 noon today with a tremendous amount of responsibility. And the question is, will the new president have the capacity to mend the economy? Is he going to be able to dispense the vaccines? And he's going to be able to calm the home front? And can he stem the trickling away of the United States' credibility since the millennium? He's got a lot on his shoulders. Does he have a plan? Because I haven't heard one yet.
Well, he does in terms of he does have certain plans. He wants to, especially today, starting today at noon, he wants to get us on the track to reenter the Paris Climate Accords. He wants to start the 100 days of masking challenge. I think that's going to be a central facet of his inauguration
speech.
What was
that? Masking?
Well, 100 days of masking. He wants to institute urge all Americans for 100 days to continue to wear our masks.
And
whether or not wherever you stand on it, personally, I think that the idea of 100 days of just saying 100 days of wearing a mask is as faulty and as fraught with problems as saying as the Trump-Pence platform of 15 days to slow the spread. Putting a time limit on these things is it only going to breed ill will. But that's a separate issue. Biden wants to make mask mandatory on all federal lands, which also includes the interstate highway system, which is interesting. But so he does have certain plans. That's for sure.
Are those the most relevant issues, or those are tertiary, you know, look good type of ideas? We're really in a quagmire as a nation. Not all the responsibility of Trump, who's leaving, but it's also the responsibility of the last presidents that we had and leading up to this particular point. And now the responsibility is on the back of Biden. I know he wants to do changes with the climate, with responsibility to shepherd the climate in a better way, so that we reduce, warming and so on and so forth. But we're also at a point where the nation is waning, where we've lost leadership to the Chinese. The Chinese are now, you know, broaching and breaching Europe with their economic capacity, and we're waning. Are we going to be able to capture any of this stuff back, or are we just going to, take second fiddle? And what will that do to Western society and our prowess as a nation, internally as well as internationally? I think those are the responsibilities he better answer. I can't wait 4 years for him to figure it out.
Well, the fact that you bring up, that's an excellent point, and we definitely have to be cautious and worry about this as a public. But the fact of the matter is, the Biden administration is going to be essentially a repeat of the Obama administration. All the key players, the majority of the key players, at least, are essentially the same. So if we expect anything different than the prior 8 years before 2016, then that's not going to it's not going to work. The question really becomes, how are we going to rebuild after the pandemic situation? And there are certain, the thing that makes the current Biden administration different than the prior Obama administration really is the fact that the two things. The pandemic will, it gives an opportunity for those who think that government can really handle rebuilding an economy to actually try that theory and to try and rebuild, even despite the fact we can argue for days on end whether or not government actually has the capacity, especially if federal government has the capacity to really do that. That's number one. But number two, there's a more radical voice in the Democratic Party than there was in 2008. There's, and even if you want to say that those radical tendencies were there, the socialistic elements of progressivism were in the Obama administration, which they were. The fact is that we have larger voices, more prominent voices that are tired of using the progressive playbook of it takes slow incremental change to get us towards where we need to go. We've passed the time for choosing, and that's part of the issue. And so that is really where the difference. And honestly, you as always, you ask such great questions, Hezzy. I have no idea. The fact that we live in such difficult times. And times that it's impossible to predict anything. The last time that that I was on the air with you was January 6th, and I was we were predicting that that there were going to be it was going to be peaceful, or we talked about the potential for a audit of the election in the Senate or the House, and then the siege of the Capitol happens. So there's no way of knowing exactly what's going to take place, and there's no unfortunately plans when we're in such a volatile type of environment. Long term plans aren't usually the best strategy.
No, well,
unfortunately,
but, you bring up a couple of very good points, but probably the most prominent as we came to the end of what you've just been saying is the responsibility to bridge the divide that does divide the nation. We can't continue to be at each other's throats because it doesn't work. It only diminishes the capacity of the nation and even the president to do what he needs to do. But he needs to define what he needs to do, and it had best sit well with the nation, because the nation is basically split, almost 50-50, could be 60-40, who knows? I can't judge it completely. But also Biden's going to have to really make sure that the vaccines are distributed, he's going to need to be able to rebuild our economy. And there are a lot of challenges there. And also, we have to recognize that we're facing a tremendous amount of pushback on the world stage, particularly from China. If we lose our way, then they become preeminent and we become second fiddle. And if we become second fiddle, we will also lose Europe in the balance. And the question is, where will Europe end? And the Chinese are preeminent because their economy is booming. And we never got answers, did we, in the last couple of years about what happened in Wuhan and with the World Health Organization and all that stuff that took place, and a lot of people poo-pooed it. But it was wrong.
You're absolutely right, and there is no answer as to what exactly. And one, by the way, bringing up the World Health Organization, Biden today wants the United States to rejoin the World Health Organization and rebuild our funding for the World Health Organization, regardless of these substantive issues that should be addressed by somebody, and why not the United States? But as far as the prominence of China and its interplay in Europe, this is the difficulty in a presidency in general, the way that we have the presidency, the way that we have structured the presidency in the United States, the fact that these types of international relations issues make a peaceful transition of power in a democratic sense very, very difficult. Make changing administrative streams mid-stride difficult, because international relations requires a long-term strategy, especially when you're dealing with authoritarian countries like China or totalitarian countries like China, where they don't have to deal with that problem. They don't have to deal with the democratic switch of issues. And when we get to a point where our international visions, where our long-term visions as a country are so divided, are polar opposites in a certain sense, that becomes a significant security concern. It becomes a significant issue as we're trying to play on the world stage, because it partly decreases our credibility. It decreases our the idea that threats are going to be taken seriously. As soon as Biden won the election in November, there were significant increases in terrorist attacks, whether that's in Nigeria. I think Nigeria was, but in other places of the world also.
In Spain.
That's horrific. It's horrendous. That's partly because there's a new administration. They know that they're going to take it in a different way, and more importantly, it's an administration with many of the same, especially in the international relations arena, that were the same players under the Obama administration. So they can predict what the policies are going to be.
Well, that's a question. I mean, when you look at Biden, I know he's, let's face it, at the end of the day, President Trump was like the majority whip that got all the Democrats together. So there was a lot of anti-Trump because of the way he managed things. However, when we look at Biden, I don't see promise. I just see a very nondescript nondescript type of character who is just going to say, well, I'm a nice guy. And the question is he competent to deliver after this four-year transition? What is he going to do? Because I never heard a plan before he got elected, and I haven't heard one yet, and I don't even know what his plan will be, or if he's just going to rest in his laurels and say, well, I'm the president, and what are you going to do about it? Are you going to be the one to be able to distribute all the medication the Dems had said that Trump couldn't do? But that wasn't Trump's fault, was it? It was because the people who created these vaccines weren't able to deliver. And now we find out they're not going to be able to deliver again, because they're going to be delayed for another month or another month and a half, because they're building the new Belgian company infrastructure so that they could serve more people. In the meantime, while we're messing up in the West, guess who's selling vaccines? China, where the capacity for an inoculation is only 50%. Successful, even though they said initially it was at 90, they lied. So the hell with all those people who are going to get the other inoculations from China, what do you call it, Sinovac. Good for them. And the Soviets are also selling, and they haven't gone through the same sort of process that we have. So which way is it going to go?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that there, in terms of vaccine rollout, first, one of Biden's starting to, mm-hmm. today for the first 100 days, he wants to get 100 million vaccines in the first 100 days, a million a day, I think, is what his estimate is. So that's significant. But at the same time, we also are experiencing recalls of certain vaccines. There are significant problems, like with Moderna, for example,
right.
partly because there wasn't no time for human testing. And so that's one of the things that I think that the Trump administration could have done better in terms of, and I understand, and again, this goes to the problem of a Democratic switch. There was a pressure to get it to get this vaccine out and get it done in time.
Was the president a scientist? Was he? Was the president a scientist? No. So if the scientist lied or deceived the president, well, then they did.
But to a certain extent, I agree with you. But to a certain extent, if there are political policy objectives, no matter who is telling the president what, there are going to be certain political pressures to get certain things done, and you can political actors have definitely been known to eschew advice, even good advice, to get their objectives done. So regardless of exactly how it happened, it wasn't done with the best of scientific capability. That's for sure. I think science has taken a significant hit, but that's a different matter entirely. There are problems with just saying about getting the vaccine out as a measure of how well we're handling this health crisis. I think that's significant. But the fact that one of the things that's very interesting about how Biden is going to be handling this vaccine, from my home state of Pennsylvania, the health secretary of the state of Pennsylvania, Rachel Levine, is now been chosen to work under the Biden administration as a leading health advisor, mainly not only because of the, and part of what most analysts are forget, Pennsylvania's lockdown restrictions and the way that Pennsylvania has handled the virus has been very similar to what Governor Cuomo has done for the state of New York, particularly with terms of nursing home deaths. But that's again another matter entirely. But what's interesting, it's not just the fact that she.
Well, I don't know in Pennsylvania what they did with the deaths in the nursing homes. In New York, the governor asked the nursing homes if they could manage this type of patient, and they all said yes. But what they were trying to manage was their bottom line. They were looking to make money. They knew they didn't have the capacity to do anything. But they lied to the governor.
Well,
many deaths, because we didn't have the ventilators. We didn't have anything that they needed in these nursing homes. It's all BS.
Well, no, nursing and it COVID, whether or not the blame falls on the nursing home saying that, you know, yes, we can keep these patients, or whether or not it's a government saying that no, this is where you need to take these patients instead of putting them in hospitals. Regardless, I've heard two different things, and the government control element is what's more happening in Pennsylvania, but. Regardless, knowing what this virus does to elderly an elderly population, to a vulnerable population, compromised population, it should never have been in the hands of nursing homes to say, oh yes, we can keep these people. No, absolutely not. So there are problems all around.
Well,
the reason
the governor asked them is simple. They were concerned of overwhelming the hospitals, and they questioned the nursing homes, and because they do have facilities, and they do take care of this population, and evidently they made a mistake, because money was the number one issue for them rather than effectiveness. So, you know, I can't blame government for asking. And then I do expect private enterprise to be honest. And to be honest with you, I can't wait till all these asshole operations get fined for all the deaths that they've caused by their ineptitude. Do you know how horrendous that is? They killed people because they were not able to function the way they required. And they knew that, but they didn't care. Would be surprised if all these people in office or who work with these private firms are going to get a bonus at the end of the year.
You might be right, but regardless, the reason I bring up that this topic with the idea of Rachel Levine, Health Secretary of the State of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, is coming into the Biden administration, and the combination between Rachel Levine and Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf has been similar to what the policies of New York. That's the primary objective. So, but with saying that, part of the reason I think that it's important to note this, part of the reason that Rachel Levine was selected is because she's a transgendered woman, and that is first openly transgender health secretary of the state of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and being a significant player in the Biden administration. It goes on to, so it's not just a matter of how the policies are going to be shaping the way that the Biden administration handles the pandemic is going to become much more centralized, much more, I would say, draconian in its capacity and in its direction. But more importantly, it goes back to the idea of identity politics, which I know is one of your favorite subjects, with the way that the Biden administration selects people, not only is it selecting people from the Obama administration from that era to continue those types of policies, but it's also choosing individuals based upon the certain character group dynamics, group characteristics that they represent. And whether or not, they're obviously, to get to a level where you're selected for this, there has to be some sort of merit involved. But at the same time, when we're choosing and we're highlighting people who fit into a certain box, you have to question what type of culture does that make? What type of culture does that make? What type of mentality does that bring? And of course, different backgrounds and different perspectives are valued and
encouraged. But I look at Biden and I say he's very nondescript.
Yes.
What defines
absolutely.
Him? Do you know what defines him? Because I have no idea what defines him. Other than he's another package, just like Hillary Clinton was a package, rammed down people's throats, divided by their very essence, and at the same time, don't get me wrong. I want to give Biden an opportunity to do something, but, I don't want to go starry-eyed and thinking, oh, my God, what a wonderful transition. I'm yawning at the prospect. I couldn't care less. It means nothing. It's just a brouhaha. It's just like, let's celebrate, pop open the champagne. What do we do after we get drunk? And then when do we sober up and realize all the responsibility that will fall on his back? And I don't see that he's ever had the capacity in the past to do something of much note.
Don't get me wrong.
I was not happy with the Trump administration. However, there was some credibility to some extent. He messed it up at the end. Which was outrageous, but look at people like McConnell who now want to admonish the president while he was there supportive of him toward the end, and now he's changed sides. He might as well become a Democrat at this point. Look at what's happening on stage.
Well,
the backstabber. And I don't care if he's a backstabber, but I care over the fact that he's been a bullshit artist for the first 4 years. And he just wants to save his skin now. He wants to stay in office. He wants the money. He wants the pension. He wants the honor.
Of course.
He wants all of that. That's all he wants.
Of course.
He's going to be a minority nobody.
Well, to a certain extent.
That's his problem, not mine.
You're so cynical today, Hezzy. But
no,
you know, I don't want
to believe in this vision, you know, if everything is wonderful, because it's not.
No,
and
absolutely,
I don't think people recognize that we're no longer preeminent as a nation. China's taken over. Financially, they're doing so much better than we. Their economy is booming. You know,
in the last quarter,
they went up 7%.
I'm going to stop because, to a certain degree, you're absolutely right. And
okay.
you're absolutely right with the threat of China, with the threat of losing American prestige to China, but you're also right about the fact that there are certain establishment players on both sides of the aisle that aren't willing to address the real problems in this country, aren't willing to, because it will jeopardize their own standing, their own power. Biden is one of them. I say hopefully, purposefully, Kamala Harris is also one, so that she won't bend the knee to the radical elements of the Democratic Party. But Mitch McConnell,
the progressives
also,
have been kept at bay. Are you talking about the progressives? They've been kept at bay. There was a lot of talk from the Ocasio-Cortez and the Bernie Sanders,
I don't consider AOC or Bernie Sanders or Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib. Those aren't progressives. They're not a traditional type of progressive. LBJ was a progressive. I would consider former President Obama and current President Biden progressives in the sense that they're willing to take incremental changes to enact a broader, more democratic socialist type of vision eventually, right? But AOC and Bernie Sanders and the entirety of the squad, the two new senators in Georgia, no, they're not progressive in the sense of the word, in the sense of the real word progressive in taking incremental stages of progress. No, they're absolutely not. They are radical.
But wasn't that the failing of the Trump administration? He wasn't incremental in his conduct. So at the end, it was one of the problems, because he didn't bring people along with him.
No, he didn't. He didn't bring people along with him. He didn't change hearts and minds. To a certain degree, he did. One of the things that he did, and you're absolutely right, he wasn't incremental about his changes. Trump is. And this again goes to the non-politician mindset, right? He doesn't think about things. He never has thought about things in a way that he's not a political player. He's a policy player. He's not a team player, but he's not a political player at all. He doesn't think in political terms. That's what I admired about him. He's a policy man. And thinking about this, going over his, if you haven't listened to or read his farewell address, I would read it instead of listening to it, especially if you are very anti-Trump and just hate his personality, because his actual words are very compelling, and he takes the time and lists. I would strongly encourage you to, and I would strongly encourage everyone to. He lists all of his accomplishments, and you think about everything that, whether it's peace in the Middle East or the U.S. Mexico Canada trade deal or the different things on the border or the Trans-Pacific Partnership climate accords, you know, things of that nature. He did so much. Love him or hate him, he was an effective person in getting things done. He is a policy man.
You're right about his accomplishments, which have never been lauded by the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, and it's forgotten as if it never happened under his watch. And the thing that's interesting, though, is that he's not getting credit for it, and I don't know why that. I don't know why that is, other than maybe the time that he got to all these accomplishments were later on in his term, and so therefore he couldn't. He needed to lay a plan. I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. But the problem was that he riled up a lot of people who resented his power, and they wanted to bring him down. That's what ended up happening. At least I think so.
You're absolutely right. I think you hit the nail on the head there. But as far as the accomplishments, in the timeline of accomplishments, he accomplished the majority of his beneficial policy, if you want to call it benefit. I'm going to try and use a more neutral word besides beneficial. He implemented all of his effective policies between his inauguration in 2017 and the start of the pandemic in January 2020. That's the time. So early in his presidency, that's when he did the most good for his base. That's for sure. That's where he was most effective. You know, he didn't handle the pandemic crisis well. He started to, and then listening to various individuals threw him off track to a certain degree. If I think he would have been better if he went with his gut instincts, but that's a different type of debate. In terms of, but I think you hit the nail right on the head with people being not necessarily jealous of his power, but feeling threatened by it. Feeling threatened by a cult of personality, which is dangerous. But also being threatened by his capacity to cut through the BS, to say no, we're not gonna do things the way it has usually been done, because what usually has been done has gotten us into this mess before. That type of philosophy not only resonated with a significant portion of the American electorate, but
that's the question, though. At the end of the day, can America have someone who is more authoritarian than a team player that brings the team along? So that means the Congress has to be brought along in a process, and they don't want somebody who's going to present a directive and say, well, we got to do it this way. So they're looking for a little input here and a little input there, so that they could all sign off on it. I think that was the only issue that really undermined the president. He didn't realize it. He was still conducting the business of the president as if he owned his own, real estate business. And you know what? He ran it almost like a little mom-pa shop, let's face it. I mean, it was all run by him. You didn't have a lot of people working there.
It wasn't like
1,000 people or 500 people or 200 people that were managing all that stuff. That was all him.
And especially with the idea of nepotism in the White House and the role of his children, of course, that they're, I think that's a valid criticism. In terms of the leadership and being a team player and things of that nature, you're absolutely right in the sense that Donald Trump has never been a team player. I don't think he ever has had to be a team player, and politics does require being able to build those types of teamwork coalition effort, especially when we get to a point where either we're so divided as a country that we need to come together, or that it comes to a crisis where there does need to be some sort of expertise involved. And I think that we hit both of those points this year. Quite evident.
When we look at the expertise that we were expecting, for example, if you remember, when it came to President Trump wanting $2,000 to be dispersed to people in need, the Republicans said no. The Democrats said no. They weren't on board. They weren't concerned about the plight of the America. And then what was interesting is the president was only able to get $600 dispersed. And now Biden comes in and says, well, I'm going to give him the extra $1,400. In the meantime, Pelosi didn't do her job.
Right.
Is it because she was resentful of the president at the time? You know,
this
is such political BS. And
yes.
You know what? And I really wonder if this nation can ever function, because it's just a lot of hot air and yet people are not delivering. And when are they going to deliver?
The only
reason McConnell is keeping his mouth shut now is because he's a minority leader.
Well, I don't think that he's really trying to keep his mouth. I think he is, in some
he's
respects.
He's trying to stay in office. What is he bringing to the equation? He said no before.
Yeah.
What's he going to say now?
One of the things that I think is very important going forward in terms of being able to, because the fact of the matter is there was no way to build unity. There was no under a Trump administration, because even when the Trump administration did make overtures to the other side, whether it was through the trying to increase the stimulus to $2,000 or whatever, there was no goodwill on either side to make a good faith effort of reconciliation.
We've become so
polarized. We don't want to side with it, because it's seen as weak. It's seen as siding with the enemy. It's seen as, which is so did and
does
so
America
wrong.
Matter
but I think that that's
part
of it.
Does America matter?
Well, America does matter, because
America.
But it's not just a matter of these are what politicians are doing at the elite level. I mean, this has been a grassroots problem for decades as well. We've become so ingrained in our patterns of behavior. We've become so ingrained in our ideology and our perspectives. But to a certain degree, it does boil down to a worldview issue. How do you see the world? How do you want to see the world? And what do you think is right and wrong? And when you have people that's divided on that basic level, we can't just have like there's going to be tonight a party with J-Lo and Tom Hanks and consider that as some sort of unity
J-Lo sounds
parade
nice.
Unity
Tom
show.
Hanks, I don't really care.
Well, but that's what's happening tonight, and they're going to be calling it some sort of unity to togetherness day or I forget the official term, but that's the theme. You can't have that, and when you have problems that have been bubbling, and you can say that they've been, especially for the past 12 years. Both sides have become so vitriolic that there isn't a clear path to some sort of unity, some sort of togetherness. We have two different ways of seeing the world, especially what's more damaging though than just having two different ways. You can coexist and have two different ways of seeing the world. I do believe that that's possible, but when you have one side trying to shut down the speech of the other side, or trying to say that, especially with the whether we want to talk about Parler or we want to talk about the efforts not even though President Trump was the first president to be impeached twice, to have the Senate now retroactively voting for his removal, despite the fact that as of 12 noon he'll no longer be the president. Regardless, mm-hmm. I mean, almost it's less than an hour and a half.
They're afraid of him, so they want to make sure that he can never survive and.
Yes,
he won't be able to come back.
But when you have that type of vitriol,
it's a con game. Look, if Biden is incapable of proving himself worthy of the office, then it doesn't matter because he won't matter, and we'll be back to the same place. And whether it be a Donald Trump or somebody else. It's going to be someone more similar to a Donald Trump who will realize that he needs to bring everybody along together and that they will have to have some framework by which you can bring people together from the extremes on the left and on the right and also the center. And
that's what we still haven't
figured out. Biden hasn't figured that out yet.
No, I don't think that he will, especially with the people that he's being surrounded by.
I agree.
He's going to. But I'm going to slightly disagree with the statement that because you just said that we'd be
in
the same place that
you're
we were.
No matter how much you
tell me that it's my show, it is your show. You're the one that okay. pays the rent. But to a certain degree, it's not that we're going to be in the same place that we were. Time doesn't work that way, unfortunately. I'd love to be in the same place as I was 3 years ago. That's not the way that it works. We're not going to be in the same place. We're going to be in an even more detrimental place if they do vote to remove and ban from office former President Trump. It's not going to work. We're going to get to a point where it is so vitriolic that it's not going to just be crushing pressure from, and that's what it feels like. If you talk to people, and I know that in some respects New York is its own little echo chamber, but if you listen to people from outside of that echo chamber who sympathize with the president, and I know you're fair and balanced, Hezzy, but it does feel like a crushing pressure. It feels like when you have, whether it's ranging from Hillary Clinton to other people in the prominent players in the Democratic Party to the head of Sesame Street calling for re-education camps for Trump supporters. When you have free speech platforms being taken down, regardless of, I mean, of course that they're going to, it has the potential to abuse technology, but when Parler was shut down on false allegations that the attacks on the Capitol were planned on Parler. No, that there's evidence now that's suggesting that they were planned on Facebook and Twitter. But regardless of that, when you have leftist hate speech against Trump supporters, that's okay on Twitter. That's you're not deplatformed. But if you dare to say anything potentially out of line on the opposite side of the aisle, when you have that's automatic cause for deplatforming and depersoning off the internet. That's a problem.
It is a problem because we have to define. And we have to discern if Facebook can be the arbiter, for example, on defining what is or is not fact.
Because they've also disseminated
issues that were not factual. They forget that because it's so easy for them to forget that.
That's true.
I don't know how much more. Look, I think the bottom line is that governance is pertinent when the political forces are subsumed and are almost irrelevant to the function of the nation, because they're functioning as political, you know, actors. But their political divide does not rise to the point where they eclipse government, a function. And that's been our problem. We have not been able to permit governance to function without the intrusion of politics, and it's become vile. The politicians have become vile, and they think they're more important than the nation, and that's the divide. And I don't know if we can bring that together, because it's so vitriolic at this point. I don't know what we're going to do. And I wonder if 4 years is enough to be able to do anything more than just watch it pass by.
Well, in you're absolutely right that 4 years isn't enough, especially if it's a problem that has taken decades to come to this point. So 4 years, one man isn't going mm-hmm. to be enough to rectify anything. Anybody who tries to tell you otherwise is lying. But regardless, it's not solely a political problem. We have put so much into politics. I mean, it goes to you shouldn't be at a point where the change of one leader or the change of even 535 in the House and Senate, mm-hmm. the change of those individual people matter that much to you. That's part of our problem. We have wasted so much of our culture.
That's the politics that has divided us.
The fact that, it's not just politics that has divided us. It's the way that we view culture. It's the way that we appreciate as history, as our history, whether it's the founding of our country, whether it's 1776 with the signing of the Declaration of Independence, or 1619 with the import of the first slave ship, whether that type of stuff, whether we think about it
but
on a day to day or not,
because whoever feels maligned by the process doesn't speak up. They've got to. There has to be discussion. We're not battling it out.
Well, it's a battle of the mind.
That's why it's so you'll win at the end of the day. So, you know, so it's unfair because here I am, you know, just deficient on so many levels. But the bottom line is we need to make sure that America is at the top of the food chain rather than our politicians who believe that they matter. They don't matter. They're there to do the people's work, and America must be at the pinnacle of the work that, and not them.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And that hasn't been the way that we have done business for decades. That's the problem.
Roosevelt did it. I wasn't born when he was around, but he did it. He put America first, and he made sure we got to work, and that we got out of our mess, and he built a nation that is formidable to this day.
Well,
even
though it's waning now, and we can talk about the benefits and failures of the FDR administration at a different date, but see that's the thing. We can talk, and I know that if I said, Hezzy, let's do a show on the history, let's do a show on the Great Depression, let's do this, we would have a civil discord conversation about
it. Well, of course.
And that's the problem, that a significant number of, whether it's political leaders or cultural elites, we can't talk to one another in this way. There isn't a willingness
to engage in
a dialogue.
Nope.
You and
we
I have a marriage counselor.
Everybody needs a marriage counselor. We evidently
everybody,
have one.
You're absolutely right.
I haven't met this marriage counselor. But it seems like it's telepathic, evidently.
Well, I think
maybe counselor, that's the only way they reach me.
Maybe we've gotten to the point where we can stop paying him, because I think that I think you and I are doing just fine.
Was it a guy?
But
it was a girl.
Well, I don't.
Maybe an ambidextrous type of character. I didn't know.
Maybe it whatever.
The wisdom, speaks to me of a woman. I don't know if men have that much wisdom.
My goodness, Hezzy. But be that as it may, we've gotten to a point in this country where we have to get back to. I don't want to talk about what, you know, we can't do this, we can't do that. That's the wrong way to look at it. I'm sorry I did. But we need to get to a point again where we can talk to one another civilly, where we can disconnect from politics to a certain degree, that not everything is controlled by politics. If we get to, and unfortunately we're heading towards, and we've gone down significantly this road, and we're heading towards an even darker path where everything is controlled by politics. That's really the definition of totalitarianism, where every aspect
That's
of
right.
every aspect of your life is controlled by the state and the ideology of the state, not just a government apparatus, but a philosophy that is wrapped up in that government apparatus. So when
you just encapsulated the whole hour, you know, here I am struggling to make the point, but you evidently do it in a minute. But that is the point, because we've allowed the politics to take over our government, and our politics is not on the same. Well, we have politicians, and they have their own little game. And
they do.
And America's lost in the process. We have lost.
And to a certain extent, we have lost. Some might say that this is a joyous day to get rid of a hated president, and which I think is unwarranted and is not helpful. But that's
hated.
The mentality. Well, some people did.
Well, some people do.
But regardless, that is the mentality. We can't ignore that mentality does exist.
Mm-hmm.
But to a certain degree, today is also a very sad day. It's a day that marks a defining shift in what we feel as a nation, what we are. The question of whether or not we are really one nation is very much in the foreground of today, and what I would urge is that both sides until 12 noon, so if for another hour, Donald Trump is the president of the United States, and when to pray, if you're a praying kind or a wishing kind, to pray for peace and goodwill for Donald Trump, and to also pray for peace and goodwill for Joe Biden. The fact that we have this one office, which is so powerful, and was never intended to be so powerful, is of paramount importance. It is of paramount importance, not just for our country and for our future, but for the as a leader in the free world, and regardless of whether or not we're waning in preeminence, as all empires do at a certain point, that's up for debate. But we still, as of today, are a major player on the world stage, and we should continue that with greatness. But we're at such a defining moment that.
Well, I think the Congress is going to work overtime to try to curtail the powers of the president. Wonder how that's going to affect Biden. You know, so there are just a lot of things that are moving parts at the moment. that a lot of people are not contemplating, but they're going to come to play in order to control the power of the president.
I'm going to disagree with you, Hezzy. I don't think that they are going to try and curtail the powers of the president, at least for another 2 years, because if they're on the same policy page, that as long as they are on the same policy page, there's no incentive for Congress to try and control the presidency. That might come in 2 years when there's midterm elections. But as far as trying to control the power of the presidency, I don't think so. We'll have to see. It will, as I said at the beginning of this hour, it's going to be an interesting day. It's going to be an interesting first 100 days, and it's going to be an interesting 4 years.
Well, you were right then, and I guess you could be right later on too.
Fingers crossed.
Well, I don't know if I want to cross my fingers on that yet, but I think my prognostication is correct, but we'll see. Have to go to the corner and, I don't know, do what. Anyway, we'll have to see what's going
to
happen.
We'll have to bet on it. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. And who knows? Maybe the bet will be we'll meet one day. You know, when you're back in Pennsylvania. So.
Oh my goodness.
Well, it's going to be very interesting. We'll see how all this goes. Well, I'm hoping Biden does well. I just don't have as much faith as all these people who have thrown their lives lock, stock, and barrel on his capacity. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's got it. That's where I am right now. I'm going to wait and see if he's got it. I don't think he does.
I'm right there with you, Hezzy, 100%. We'll see. All we can do is wait.
Well, we're on the same page. I can't believe it. It took us an hour to get on the same page. I can't stand it.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I don't know. So we didn't need the marriage counselor after all today.
I tell you, we got to just take him off the books. But
I think so.
Oh, my goodness.
Spend it on flowers or something. Or maybe, I don't know, a bottle of champagne to Mr. Biden in the hope that he'll have an opportunity to take a swig and get on with the job. We'll see.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, boy. Well, Thank you so much, Hezzy.
All the best to you. Thank you very much for all your input. It's too civil. I don't know. Maybe we should do something about this program. We're too nice to one another. Do we need to
fire the marriage
counselor or something?
I think we need to fire the marriage counselor, and it'll make things more interesting.
Well, that's a great idea. You know, let's dump it on the marriage counselor. Blame the marriage counselor. That's like a perfect idea. All right, next time we talk, we'll have to do something about that. Plan ahead.
My goodness. Thank you so
much,
Hezzy.
You just have a great week. Thanks so much for your input. Be well. Stay healthy.
Bye.
Take care. Thanks. Bye. Well, there we have it. Gabriella Metzl, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Unvarnished Blog. Always a pleasure talking to her. Okay. So let's see what else is going on in our neck of the woods. That was very interesting. I was trying to figure out a word before. One of the words that I was looking up was apotheosis. Apotheosis is the glorification of a subject or to a divine level. That's something that we saw with regard to Donald Trump. However, it's really a theological term, and it has meaning in theology as opposed to referring to, you know, individuals who are not of the cloth, so to speak. President Trump was an apotheotic type of character. We'll see where Mr. Biden goes, and we'll see if there are any changes to his demeanor and how what he'll be able to accomplish. So we'll see. It is just what it is. Okay, let me go back to our studio screen. And here we are. Let's find out what's happening at the Cabot Creamery, and we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Well, sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. there are a lot of things happening. I guess the most important thing is the anticipation of the swearing-in ceremony with regard to Mr. Biden and Ms. Harris. So that's going to be very, very interesting, to say the least. And we should really look at it. Joe Biden's going to be sworn in as the 46th U.S. president in an uncommon inauguration ceremony. So he's going to take the reins of the country, divided after 4 years of Donald Trump and after the Republican candidates sowed doubt in the electoral process, refusing to concede defeat. So, Biden will be the oldest president to be sworn in. He at 78 years of age. And there are a lot of things that are going to make this particular swearing-in ceremony very different. I'm sure we'll just have to see what that proves to be, and we'll go from there. Then there are other. This is indicative of what we were talking about before. In the battle for the soul of a nation, Joe Biden offers, or supposedly offers, an antidote to Trump. Biden, the U.S. president-elect, has cast himself as a moderate with the experience and empathy required to offset Donald Trump's disruptive presidency. So having battled adversity throughout a career scarred by personal tragedy, he says he feels the pain of a nation unnerved by economic crisis, civil unrest, and a deadly pandemic. So he's a former vice president under Barack Obama, and Biden is the first candidate to notch more than 80 million votes nationwide in a presidential contest, ultimately securing a clear path to victory after days of nail-biting suspense. So he's an affable figure with several decades of Washington experience, and Biden has vowed to restore dignity to the presidential office after four uniquely turbulent years under President Donald Trump, a former real estate tycoon and reality TV host. Well, both white male septuagenarians, the two rivals share at least one other trait, an avowed populist strain when it comes to addressing blue-collar America. Now, most other counts, however, the veteran Democrats is Trump's polar opposite, a seasoned politician with a track record of forging bipartisan deals, overcoming setbacks, voicing compassion, and owning up to past errors. So Biden, who's known for his personal warmth and resilience, enters the Oval Office at age 78, making him the oldest first-term president in the nation's history, 32 years after the first of his three presidential runs ended in a humiliating withdrawal. While the former senator from Delaware also ran for Democratic nomination in 2008 before dropping out and joining the Obama ticket, and his 8 years as a deputy to Obama have allowed him to lay claim to much of the former president's legacy, including the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, and the economic stimulus package that brought the United States car industry back from the brink of collapse. So while some might dispute Obama's description of Biden as the best vice president America has ever had, there is little doubt he ranked among the most loyal and proactive vice presidents, readily undertaking, in his own words, quote, every shit job in the world, end quote, that Obama passed on. The enduring association with the country's first black president helped mobilize support from African-American voters during the Democratic primaries, just as Biden had helped win over blue-collar white voters for Obama in 2008. And once again, those working-class credentials proved crucial in the November 3 election, allowing Biden to reclaim key battleground states in the Rust Belt, starting with his birthplace, Pennsylvania, which Trump flipped 4 years ago. Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. was born on November 20 of 1942 in Scranton, a blue-collar city in northeast Pennsylvania, into a Catholic family of Irish descent. He was 13 when the family moved to neighboring Delaware, a state that would later he would later represent in the United States Senate for nearly four decades. Biden frequently touts his working-class background, crediting his parents with instilling in him the values of hard work and perseverance. He was often recounted, or has often recounted, his father, who worked cleaning furnaces and as a car salesman, saying that, quote, the measure of a man is not how often he is knocked down, but how quickly he gets up. Long before Trump dubbed his Sleepy Joe, the young Biden was bullied in school, nicknamed Dash, because of a debilitating stutter, which he eventually overcame by reading poetry out loud in front of a mirror. Of greater challenges would eventually follow. So after graduating from law school in 1968, Biden briefly worked for a law firm before quitting to become a public defender as Delaware cracked down on a rash of riots in response to Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. He was just 29 when he turned to politics, stunning a popular Republican incumbent in a November 1972 Senate race to become the fifth youngest U.S. senator in history. But the joy was short-lived. Just days before Christmas, his first wife, Nelia, and infant daughter, Naomi, were killed when a tractor trailer slammed into the family's station wagon, an accident that also left his toddler sons, Beau and Hunter, hospitalized. Ready to relinquish the seat he had just won, a bereaved Biden was convinced to serve out his term by Senate colleagues and was famously sworn into office by his own son's hospital bed. Well, his daily commutes by train between Washington and Wilmington, Delaware, a practice he maintained throughout his Senate career to remain close to his family, would cement his image as a caring father. Biden later had another daughter, Ashley, with his second wife, Jill, his partner of more than 40 years. But personal tragedy would strike again during his second term as vice president when his son, Beau, a Delaware attorney general who was contemplating a run for governor, died of brain cancer in 2015 at the age of 46. In his tributes to Beau on the campaign trail, Biden has credited his late son with encouraging him to launch one more run for the White House. Throughout his six terms as U.S. president, Biden earned broad respect and cultivated friendships on both sides of the aisle, but his career could easily have ended back in 1988, following the double blow of a short-lived first presidential run and the discovery of two life-threatening brain aneurysms. Complications from the ensuing brain surgery led to blood clots in his lungs and further surgery, but the defiant senator was soon back in his seat. Biden engineered the rejection of former President Ronald Reagan's Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork, an arch conservative, while serving as head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. His ability to sway moderate Republicans would become a hallmark of his success in forging political compromise, giving him less visibility, but arguably more impact and more vocal than more local liberals in his own party. A few years later, Biden leveraged the same skills to engulf bipartisan compromise on some of Bill Clinton's signature initiatives, including a ban on assault weapons and passing the 1994 Violence Against Women Act. Biden attempted to reprise his role as political peacekeeper during his tenure as vice president, though the mission was made harder by the increasing intransigence of the Republican camp, driven in part by the Tea Party movement and then Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who pressured Republicans not to compromise with the Obama administration. McConnell famously once said that the single most important thing, quote unquote, for his party was to make Obama a one-term president. Well, still, Biden proved crucial to brokering last-minute deals in increasingly acrimonious budget tussles with the GOP to avert or end government shutdowns. He was equally active on the foreign policy front, though he was often at the losing end of internal discussions. He advised against the raid on Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, a sovereign U.S. ally until the intelligence on his whereabouts was more certain, as well as the 2009 troop surge in Afghanistan. On the campaign trail, Biden has promised to roll back Trump's signature moves on foreign policy, starting with his decision to quit the Paris Climate Accord, and has vowed to reach out to U.S. allies alienated by Trump and re-engage with Iran over its disputed nuclear program. Well, since he emerged as a Democratic frontrunner, Biden and his family have faced withering attacks from the U.S. president, who notoriously asked his Ukrainian counterpart to investigate the business dealings of Biden's youngest son, Hunter. And that request led to Trump being impeached by the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, although he was subsequently acquitted by the Republican-led Senate. Well, Biden's lengthy Senate career has also given critics within his own Democratic Party ample material for attacks. And ahead of the party primaries, he was sharply criticized for his handling of allegations of sexual harassment that Anita Hill leveled at Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas in 1991, while Biden was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Republican committee members questioned her credibility, and Hill has said that Biden failed to rein in his colleagues during the hearing. Last year, Biden apologized to Hill, who has since said she would be willing to work with him on gender issues. His record was again on the spot during the first primary debate, as rival Democratic candidate Kamala Harris took him to task for opposing court-ordered busing to integrate schools. And in a subsequent interview, Biden maintained that federally mandated busing did not work, but that he was in favor of local busing efforts aimed at desegregating schools. Biden would later pick Harris as his vice president, making her the first woman of color to run on a major party ticket. And during the primary contest, the former vice president was also described as too moderate and out of touch by the increasingly vocal left wing of the Democratic Party that rallies behind Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Biden supporters countered by stressing his decades spent fighting for racial justice in the United States and abroad, including a passionate Senate speech about the repulsive, repugnant regime in apartheid South Africa. He also cited his endorsement of gay marriage during the 2012 campaign ahead of a more prudent Obama as evidence of his progressive credentials and political courage. Well, the affable, contact-loving former vice president has also had to fend off some accusations of improper conduct in his interactions with female aides. He has defended his habit of hugging and touching people he meets, saying he always saw politics as a matter of personal connection. While Trump has openly bragged about groping and forcefully kissing women, Biden has promised to be more mindful of personal space in the future. He has certainly proved more mindful of social distancing rules, sporting protective face masks from the start of the coronavirus pandemic, even as his Republican rival dismissed the importance of masks and downplayed a virus that has killed more than 230,000 U.S. citizens and infected dozens of people working in the White House. So throughout the campaign, Democratic nominee repeatedly characterized the 2020 U.S. election as a battle for the soul of this nation, asked in a CNN interview whether he was the polar opposite of Trump, a smiling Biden crossed himself and said, "I hope so." After suffering a string of early setbacks in the race for the Democratic nomination, including a bruising fifth-place finish in the New Hampshire primary that might have taken the stuffing out of lesser candidates, Biden got back up, eventually sailing past his rivals. And in March, after a resounding victory on Super Tuesday that revived his political fortunes, he greeted supporters with a line that mirrors his own life story. "For those who have been knocked down, counted out, left behind, this is your campaign." So months later, during a grueling vote count that stretched over 4 days, Biden weathered an early Republican surge before mail-in ballots eventually turned the tide. Fittingly, the victory came from his home state of Pennsylvania, the centerpiece of Trump's stunning success 4 years before. Now, the tycoon president had famously likened himself to local hero Rocky Balboa, even pasting his face on a picture of the fictional boxer's bare chest. In the end, Sleepy Joe proved a better match for the teary-eyed, clumsy talker from Philadelphia, whose strength lay not so much in the blows he delivered as in the many punches he soaked up. So, very compelling character, to say the least. All we can do is wish him well. It's going to be a tough slog, that's for sure. A lot of challenges in the national and on the international realm. So, unbelievable. Okay, so let's just look at... let me just look at some other things that what might be of value for your consideration. Let's just see in a moment. one second. Well, this was really not nice. Evidently, Trump has left the White House for the last time, snubbing Biden's inauguration. So the U.S. president left the White House for the final time on Wednesday, heading by helicopter to a nearby military base where he was to fly to Florida, skipping the inauguration of successor Joe Biden in an extraordinary break with tradition. Trump was 74, and First Lady Melania Trump walked a short red carpet and boarded Marine One on the White House lawn on a sunny but chilly day in Washington for the short flight to Joint Base Andrews, where he will board Air Force One. In brief remarks to reporters, Trump said it had been an amazing 4 years and the honor of a lifetime. I just want to say goodbye, he said. Trump will be at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida when Biden is sworn in at noontime as the 46th president of the United States. That's about, 36 minutes from now. A more elaborate departure ceremony is planned at Joint Base Andrews, including a 21-gun salute and remarks by the outgoing president, the first to skip the inauguration of his successor in more than 150 years. So Trump repeatedly and falsely claimed that he won the November 3 presidential election, and his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th in a bid to disrupt the certification by Congress of Biden's victory. So that was the big to-do. And 1 second. Let me just check this out. Bear with me a moment. All right, let's just look. Bear with me a second here. This is interesting because this comes from France. Evidently, no repentance, no apologies for colonial abuses in Algeria, says Macron. French President Emmanuel Macron has ruled out issuing an official apology for abuses in Algeria, his office said today, ahead of a major report on how France is facing up to its colonial past in the country. There will be no repentance nor apologies for the occupation of Algeria for the bloody 8-year war ended French rule, Macron's office had said, adding that the French leader would instead take part in symbolic acts aimed at promoting reconciliation. So the atrocities committed by both sides during the 1954 to 1962 Algerian War of Independence continue to strain relations between the two countries 6 decades later. Well, Macron, the first president born after the colonial period, has gone further than any of his predecessors in recognizing French crimes in Algeria. Later on Wednesday, a historian commissioned by the president was assessing the, quote, progress made by France on the memory of the colonization of Algeria and the Algerian War, and, quote, will submit his findings. Benjamin Stora's report is not, however, expected to recommend that France issue an apology, but rather suggest ways of shedding light on one of the darker chapters of French history and propose ways of promoting healing. The presidency said that Macron would take part in 3 days of commemoration next year, marking the 60th anniversary of the end of the Algerian War, and each day will be dedicated to a different group suffered in the conflict. That's what the presidential aides had advised. So we'll have to see where that goes. More continuing on, at least 43 African migrants drowned off of Libya. That's what UN agencies had said. You know, the plight of people trying to depart from countries where there are no opportunities in life is overwhelming. Now, let's just look at this really important. Jack Spack, evidently Chinese tycoon Ma, Jack Ma, makes his first public appearance since the Alibaba crackdown. So Jack Ma, the billionaire founder of Chinese internet behemoth Alibaba, made his first public appearance in over 2 months in an online video on Wednesday, ending weeks of speculation about his whereabouts. In the 50-second video, Ma congratulated teachers supported by the foundation and made no mention of his disappearance or official efforts to tighten control over Alibaba and other internet companies over the past 6 months. Well, the video appeared on Chinese business news and other websites. Normally voluble Ma disappeared from public view after he irked regulators by criticizing them in an October 24 speech at a Shanghai conference. Days later, regulators suspended the planned multi-billion dollar stock market debut of the Ant Group, A-N-T, Group, a financial platform that grew out of Alibaba's payment service, Alipay. Shortly afterwards, the record-breaking $37 billion initial public offering, IPO, of his financial group, Ant, was spiked at the last minute by Chinese regulators in a shock move, which some saw as retaliation for Ma's outspokenness. Ma Foundation said in a statement released on Wednesday, quote, Jack Ma participated in the online ceremony of the annual Rural Teacher Initiative event on January 20th. The foundation and Alibaba didn't respond to questions about Ma's status and when his next public meeting, or rather event, might be. In the speech, Ma praised China's poverty alleviation efforts, a central target of the communist leadership, and vowed to dedicate more efforts toward helping rural teachers. My colleagues and I are even more determined to devote ourselves to education and public welfare, he said, according to a transcript of his speech published by Chinese news site Tianmu News. China has entered a new stage of development and is moving towards common prosperity. Well, since the Ant-IPO was quashed, Chinese regulators have launched an anti-monopoly probe into Alibaba. Both Alibaba and Ant said they will cooperate with regulatory requests. Ma is a characteristic former teacher turned internet entrepreneur, retired as chairman of Alibaba in 2019, but has long attracted attention for his outspokenness and flamboyant antics, performing as a rock star at company conferences. Continued squeeze on one of China's most influential companies is the latest sign that the leadership is ready to deflate the inflammable of big business firms in a response internet, in a runaway internet sector. Beijing has a history of disappearing, investigating, and imprisoning financial tycoons who do not toe the party line. So last year, outspoken real estate tycoon Ren Zhixian was jailed for 18 years on alleged corruption charges, months after penning an essay critical of the Communist Party. So we'll just have to see where all this goes. Bear with me a moment. We're only on till 12, so we'll just have to see if we can get some coverage of the president swearing in. I doubt seriously it's going to take place before 12 noon, but I just want to recheck. You never know, but it's unlikely. Okay, 1 second. Let's just see. No, I guess not. I don't think it is going to go through well, before 12. So it's just the luck of the draw, as they say. The 10 to 12 time slot was very good for us. Evidently not for the swearing-in ceremony, which is a shame. So let's look at what else is happening around the world. Hold on 1 second. All right, 1 more second. Okay. It doesn't look like we've got anything else. We spoke to you about the first national elections in 15 years by the Palestinian territories. They didn't have an election for 15 years. Unbelievable. So just is what it is. Well, it looks like it's time for us to depart. I don't see anything else to share with you at the moment. Just one more. I'm going to go through this really quickly, just in case any new news came out somewhere. Okay. Nothing here on the national stage. Let's just see if there's anything else on the international stage that's of value. Look at that. Well, this is very interesting with regard to Biden. And in the business world, it seems that Biden is expected to block the Keystone XL pipeline. Listen to this report. This is coming from Franz Verkat. One second.
It's time now for a check of the top business news stories. I'm joined by our business editor, Kate Moody. Hi there, Kate.
Hi, Tom.
Now, the president-elect in the United States, Joe Biden, planning to issue quite a number of executive orders right from the get-go. One of them could be a U-turn on a controversial oil pipeline.
Yeah, wading into something that we've seen a lot of back and forth on over the last decade or so, the Keystone XL oil pipeline was blocked by the Obama administration, then approved by Donald Trump. Joe Biden is now preparing to revoke that construction permit. The $8 billion project aims to streamline the delivery of 500,000 barrels of crude oil per day from Alberta, Canada, to refineries in Texas. That dotted blue line on our map there shows the 2,000-kilometer portion, which remains unbuilt. Now, Barack Obama blocked the project in 2015, arguing that it would add to carbon emissions and benefit Canada's economy more than the U.S. Trump overturned that decision 2 years later, but a number of environmental groups have filed so far unsuccessful lawsuits to halt progress. Canadian officials have said the expected move by Biden could cost thousands of jobs, while the company in charge of the extension, TC Energy, has said it will only use renewable energy to power that pipeline if it's allowed to go ahead. Well, one area where Biden isn't expected to immediately reverse course is the U.S. trading relationship with China. This weekend, Trump took one of his last shots at the Chinese tech giant Huawei by reportedly revoking licenses to U.S. suppliers, including chipmaker Intel. His administration has taken steps to cut business ties and isolate Huawei in both hardware and the rollout of 5G technology because of concerns about the company's links to the Chinese government. Well, China's government grew 2.3% last year, the only major economy not to contract in 2020. GDP expanded 6.5% in the last quarter year-on-year, outpacing its pre-pandemic growth rate, this despite international criticism and skepticism over the government's handling of the virus. A strong pickup in industrial production and exports boosted the economy. Global demand for Chinese-made protective medical equipment and electronics has been strong. Our correspondent Charles Pellegrin reports from Beijing.
First and foremost, what's behind this is China's decisive response to the COVID-19 pandemic on its own territory that's allowed work to resume and allowed supply chains to basically pick up where they left off. We've seen a V-shaped recovery. During the first quarter of 2020, the economy went down 6.8%, and then at the end of 2020 Q4, it went up 6.5%. And this is basically because China closed its borders and then did everything it could to stomp on any local transmission of the virus. After that, the export sector in China benefited. China is a huge producer of medical equipment and medical goods, so we've seen Chinese-made masks being exported around the world as well as other equipment. And in general, Chinese exporters have managed to gain market share on their foreign competitors, who often are still dealing with virus restrictions around the world. So really, China looking like it's coming out of this pandemic strengthens China's economy as opposed to the rest of the world's economy that still appears to be quite weakened.
Let's check in on the day's trading action. Now, Wall Street is closed for the Martin Luther King holiday. A mixed close for the major European indices saw the FTSE 100 ending slightly lower. The DAX and CAC both slightly above the flat line there. Carrefour shares fell about 7%. Monday also saw the market debut of Stellantis. That's the new name of the car company combining PSA Peugeot and Fiat Chrysler. $52 billion merger was finalized over the weekend, creating the world's fourth largest car manufacturer by volume. Shares rose over 7% in both Paris and Milan. Stellantis will also launch on the New York Stock Exchange on Tuesday. The French pharmaceutical giant Sanofi is pushing ahead with plans to cut some 1,700 jobs across Europe, as it announced last year. But unions said on Monday they'd been told that would include 400 employees in its research and development division here in France. The drug maker is partnering with GlaxoSmithKline to develop a COVID-19 vaccine, but they've fallen behind the likes of Pfizer and Moderna. Sanofi's management told AFP that the restructuring wouldn't affect the company's output, and the French finance minister says the government will oppose any layoffs. But employees say they're still worried about the broader implications.
Pour moi, c'est pas admissible parce qu'en fait, on fait énormément de bénéfices, on a beaucoup d'argent dans l'entreprise, donc on a les moyens d'embaucher, on a les moyens de remplacer les gens qui partent.
On a l'impression qu'on est là maintenant pour plus pour produire des choses qu'on sait faire, mais qu'on est incapable d'innover. Donc voilà, moi pour l'innovation, ça me fait peur.
Well, the pandemic has wreaked havoc on the business world, but there's a silver lining for some here in France. Nearly 850,000 new companies were created last year. A record for French entrepreneurs. Julia Kim has more.
Wow.
Every week, this young fashion designer delivers her wares to this boutique in Lille. Soaps, vegetal sponges, and cloth tissues, all 100% French and created to limit waste. Last year, Sophie Tulpin left her job to launch her own business.
Fabrication, vous ne retrouvez pas vraiment dans les valeurs qui étaient
véhiculées par les chaussures étaient fabriquées des milliers de kilomètres de chez nous.
Et donc, pour le coup, j'avais vraiment la volonté de faire quelque chose qui est du sens, qui soit plus local.
But so far, her business has yet to turn a profit.
L'objectif, effectivement, c'est d'arriver en 2021. Mais c'est assez prometteur parce que sur l'année 2020, je me suis lancée en mars, j'ai réalisé près de 35 000 euros.
But for the moment, she depends on unemployment benefits. Sophie is one of 848,160 people in France that launched their own business in 2020, an increase of 4% compared to 2019. The majority of these new entrepreneurs are between 18 to 29 years old and are often job seekers themselves. The pandemic has seen demand soar for delivery personnel and drivers. Two-thirds of these new businesses were registered by the self-employed, a status that's recommended for those who work with delivery and logistics platforms. Over 2.5 million people are currently unemployed in France. The jobless rate rose to 9%, with over 600,000 people losing their jobs in the third quarter of 2020.
Disneyland Paris has said it will not reopen its doors until at least April, 7 weeks later than it initially planned because of the pandemic. The theme park, which employs some 17,000 people, closed between March and July last year, and it's been shut again since the end of October. Management now expects a return to pre-pandemic levels of activity only in 2022 at the very earliest. Mm-hmm. Park's parent company is cutting some 32,000 jobs, most of them at their two U.S. theme parks. No job cuts announced for the moment at Disneyland Paris, Tom. But of course, if they're forced to stay shut longer and longer, if the crowds don't come back when they do reopen, it could be a different story.
Yeah, tough times in so many sectors. Thank you very much indeed, our business editor, Kate Moody. Thanks for that.
Okay, there it is. Turns out Kamala Harris has been sworn in as the vice president, shattering the gender and racial barrier for the first time. So that's very, very encouraging. And I guess President-elect will be sworn in very shortly. So that's going to be really, really nice. So I guess that's about it. Well, to go back to our studio screen, say thank you. It's about 15 minutes before the noontime. So I want to see the swearing in myself. I hope you'll consider that as my farewell to you. So tune in if you have an opportunity to do so. Take care and goodbye.